Thank you. And seems like people are kind of excited. And so am I. I did come here to speak to all of you in 1975, a long time ago. But some of you may have forgotten or probably weren't born then. I came here in 1959 for the first time in my sacerdotal garb as a Jesuit seminarian, my Roman collar and my little black suit. I sat right down there. I looked up at my father, give his first State of the State way back in 1959. So, Lieutenant Governor, I appreciate change, but I also value continuity. In fact, I used to say, take the ins and throw them out, take the outs and put them in. I don't say that anymore. My message, there's no substitute for experience. Anyway, here I am. I'm here to report on the state of our state, choosing to ignore those who say that Article 5 of our Constitution, which requires the governor to report to the legislature, is outdated. That you can't report on the condition of our state from Sacramento because California is too spread out and too diverse. It occurred to me that these critics, who have long recited our state's decline, perhaps have nothing to say in the face of California's comeback, except, please, don't report it. Well, I'm going to report it. And what a comeback it is. 1 million new jobs since 2010. A budgetary surplus in the billions. In the billions. But don't spend it. That's the point. And a minimum wage rising to $10 an hour. This year, Californians have a lot to be proud of. For a decade, budget instability was the order of the day. A lethal combination of national recessions, improvident tax cuts, and too much spending created a financial sinkhole that defied every effort to climb out. But 3 years later, here we are, with state spending and revenues solidly balanced, and more to come. For that, I thank all of you for your courageous and dedicated legislative work. It's truly impressive. I also want to thank the members of my administration who've worked so hard to help make all this happen. But above all else, I think we should thank the voters of California. In 2010, through In 2010, through Proposition 25, they established a majority vote for passage of the state budget. That ended the gridlock, and then in 2012, they approved the temporary tax increases of Proposition 30. These two initiatives, together with the recovering economy and the tough decisions you took, made all the difference. But we're not out of the woods, and we're certainly not out of the drought. Life is uncertainty. The climate is changing, not for the better, and the business cycle and the stock market are historically volatile, with good years followed by bad with painful regularity. And while we know our revenues will fluctuate up and down, our long-term liabilities are enormous, and they're ever-growing. Let me list some of them. Well over $100 billion for pensions owed to our state workers, teachers, and judges. Tens of billions needed. By the way, judges, it's $3 billion, just so you kind of understand. You're part of the problem, too. It's only $3 billion. Teachers and public employees are well over 100. Tens of billions are needed to cover retiree health care, more like $60 billion. And $65 billion is needed to maintain and keep our roads and our buildings and our other infrastructure in sound repair. And we must also account for future risks that could negatively affect our budgets, like congressional decisions, natural disasters, and the uncertain costs of the Affordable Care Act. So we can't go back to business as usual. Boom and bust is our lot, and we must follow the ancient advice recounted in the book of Genesis that Joseph gave to the Pharaoh. Put away your surplus during the years of great plenty so you'll be ready for the lean years which are sure to follow. Most governors and legislators in modern times have forgotten this advice. This time we won't do that. We'll pay down our debts and remember the lessons of history. The American philosopher George Santayana famously said, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." To help us keep our fiscal realities in mind, I have some playing cards here that puts the chart that's in the budget summary of the last 15 years. You probably can't see this, but it's mostly red with a little black in the beginning and the end. But just not to discourage you and lift your spirits, I put something on the back of this playing card, a picture of Sutter, and underneath, well, on this side, we have the quote from George Santayana, "Don't forget, you know, those who forget the past will repeat it." On this side, Sutter makes a number of little comments. For this one says, "Bark if you don't like deficits." And so we have a few of them. I'm going to put this right here just in case, we forget. And if I had Sutter here, he'd be barking. You could be sure of that. All right. Fiscal discipline is not the enemy of our democracy, but its fundamental predicate. To avoid the mistakes of the past, we must spend with great prudence, and we must also establish a solid rainy day fund locked into the Constitution. In 2004, the people voted for a rainy day fund, which was found to be unworkable. In 2010, you created another rainy day fund, now scheduled for the November election. But this latest effort doesn't give the state the option to pay off its debts, doesn't deal with the ups and downs of Proposition 98, and doesn't account for the spikes in capital gains. So let's fix these flaws before going back to the voters. And this is work that we need to accomplish in the next few months. Last year, I spoke of the principle of subsidiarity, a rather clunky word that nevertheless points to a profoundly important principle, namely that in our federal system, there are separate layers of government, each with its own distinct responsibilities. The Oxford Dictionary defines subsidiarity as the idea that a central authority should have a subsidiary function, performing only those tasks which cannot be formed effectively at a more immediate or local level. No better example of this can be found than in your enactment last year of the local control funding formula. This was a major breakthrough in the way funds are allocated to California schools, so their laws explicitly recognize the difficult problems faced by low-income families and those whose first language is other than English. As a result, those with less are going to receive more, and that's good for all of us. But something else is at work in this local funding formula. Instead of prescriptive commands issued from headquarters here in Sacramento, more general goals have been established for each local school to attain, each in its own way. This puts the responsibility where it has to be, in the classroom and at the local district. With 6 million students, there is no way the state can micromanage teaching and learning in all the schools from El Centro to Eureka. And we shouldn't even try. Last week, 324 people from across the state traveled to Sacramento to speak to the State Board of Education about the merits of this new law and the regulations which should be adopted under it. Principals, teachers, students, parents, religious groups, and of course lawyers all came forward to express their views. Now, that shows interest and it shows real commitment. But their work is just beginning. Each local district now has to put into practice what the local funding formula has made possible. That, together with the new Common Core standards for math and English, will be a major challenge for teachers and local administrators. But they're the ones who can make it work, and I have every confidence that they will. In a similar vein, in the field of public safety, we've changed historic practices in our prison system and transferred significant responsibilities to local authorities. The federal courts, backed up by the United States Supreme Court, have ordered major reductions in our prison population and dramatic improvements in the medical and mental health programs that the states makes available. In response, we transferred the supervision of tens of thousands of lower level offenders from the state to our 58 counties. This realignment is bold and far-reaching, but it's also necessary under the circumstances, and local law enforcement has risen to the occasion. Our prisons are pioneering new programs and treatments, but so are the counties. Last week, I visited the Laredo Jail just north of Bakersfield and sat in on some classes. It was moving to hear the men's stories and their struggles. It was also inspiring to see the enthusiasm of Sheriff Donnie Youngblood and his efforts under realignment to work with probation, the district attorney, local judges, and the police to find new ways to deter crime and help offenders straighten out their lives. Of course, there are issues with realignment, but together with our local partners, we're facing them. We have plenty of work ahead of us, including building more capacity at the state and the county level and becoming more effective with those who suffer mental illness or who are drug addicted. But we're on the right track, and we want to stick to that. In all this, your legislative work, particularly funding, is crucial. But we should never lose sight of the reality that life is local, and that so many things we try to do here in the state capitol can only be handled by local representatives and leaders, or the people themselves. These problems that we face, they deal not with abstractions, the abstractions of the law, but with flesh and blood reality of everyday life. That's a lesson I learned as mayor of Oakland. Among all our uncertainties, weather is one of the most basic. We can't control it, we can only live with it. And now we have to live with a very serious drought of uncertain duration. Right now, it's imperative that we do everything possible to mitigate the effects of the drought. I've convened an interagency drought task force, declared a state of emergency. We need everyone in every part of the state to conserve water. We need regulators to rebalance water rules and enable voluntary transfers of water. And we must prepare for forest fires. As the state water action plan lays out, water recycling, expanded storage, and serious groundwater management must all be part of the mix. So too must investments in safe drinking water, particularly in the disadvantaged communities. We also need wetlands and watershed restoration and further progress on the Bay Delta Conservation Plan. It's a tall order, but it is what we must do to get through this drought and get ready for the next one. We do not know how much our current problems derives from the buildup of heat-trapping gases, but we can take this drought as a stark warning of things to come. The United Nations Panel on Climate Change says with 95% confidence that human beings are changing our climate. This means more droughts, more extreme weather events, and in California, more forest fires and less snowpack. As you know, of all the states, and even most of the countries of the world, California is the leader in dealing with climate change. From AB 32 to our building and appliance efficiency standards, our renewable portfolio standard, and our support of electric vehicles, California is leading the way. Nevertheless, in terms of greenhouse gases, our biggest challenge remains the amount of gasoline Californians use. Each year, our motor vehicles use more than 14 billion gallons of gasoline to travel 330 billion miles. I said billion. To put those numbers in perspective, the sun is 93 million miles away. Reducing our oil consumption, two-thirds of which is imported by ships and tank cars, increasingly, will take time. It'll take breakthrough technologies and steadfast commitment. It will also require that the countries which burn the most fossil fuel join with us. We started building those partnerships with other states and countries like China. We'll go to Mexico next, because California can't do it alone. In so many other ways, California is a pioneer. We have 25% of the nation's foreign-born, and we're the first state in modern times to have a plurality of families of Latino origin. So it's not surprising that California is the state where immigrants can not only dream, they can drive legally. We're also the state of innovation, of Silicon Valley, and more venture capital investment than any other state by far. We're on our way to 1 million electric vehicles, and we're building the nation's only high-speed rail. We're expanding health care coverage to millions more. And California is the nation's leader in developing medical and scientific advances that will cure diseases and lower costs. We have 6 of America's 12 top-performing metropolitan areas in biotechnologies: San Diego, San Jose, San Francisco, Oakland, Los Angeles, and Orange County. Last year, we created a tax credit to help innovators in these regions and beyond hire and expand in California. 4 of the world's 20 leading academic bioscience institutions are located here in California: UCSF in Berkeley, UCLA, Stanford, and UC San Diego. Just as California has led the way with stem cell research, so too we can pioneer the new fields of precision medicine, which uses genomics, medical devices, computer sciences, and other fields to treat individual patients instead of broad populations. Yes, California is a leader in so many ways, but the dangers and the difficulties we face can never be taken lightly. We still have too many struggling families, too much debt, and too many unknowns when it comes to our climate. Overcoming these challenges will test our vision. It'll test our discipline, and it'll test our ability to persevere. But overcome them we will, and as we do, we'll build for the future, not steal from it. Thank you.